Welcome once again to the History of the Catholic Church in the United States. You recall in our first episode we were speaking about the Spanish and the French colonizing efforts in the 16th and 17th centuries. We're going to remain in the 17th century now as we start talking about Catholic contributions to British colonizing efforts. And we must begin that story, of course, with the colony of Maryland, or as it's even more properly called, the Palatinate of Maryland. It's the Palatinate of Maryland because it was an unusual grant of land given by a king of England to a proprietor. It was an unusual grant of land because the proprietor was given enormous powers and privileges that other proprietors were not given. Well, the story begins now in 1634. In that year, two ships, the Ark and the Dove, set sail from England in the winter months. They arrived in Maryland, they sailed up the Potomac, and they landed in March of 1634. On those two ships, the Ark and the Dove, you had a rather unusual combination of people. First of all, you had a large number of Catholic noblemen. Secondly, you had three Jesuits. And finally, you had a number of servants, some of them Catholic, but the larger number of them non-Catholic. It was a somewhat unusual group of people, not necessarily the types that you would think would be coming to the New World together at the same time to begin a colonizing effort. And yet with the arrival of this group of people on the shores of Maryland in the spring of 1634, a new chapter was about to open in the history of British colonization. Maryland was a colony in which, as one contemporary described it, love and amity were supposed to exist between all the members of the colony. Believe me, it didn't always work out that way, but it certainly was a noble ideal. Primarily, the colony of Maryland was a commercial enterprise. It was not a haven for persecuted Catholics from England. Rather, it was primarily a commercial enterprise. Now, we don't want to say that religion was not going to play any part. Religion most certainly would play a very significant part from the very earliest days of the foundation of Maryland, and the career of a man by the name of George Calvert saw to it that religion was going to play a very significant part in the development of colonial Maryland. George Calvert had been born in Yorkshire in England, and although his parents had been Roman Catholics, they conformed to the Church of England at the time of the Reformation. Calvert's early training was given to him by an Anglican clergyman. He was apparently very, very bright, a wonderful student. He entered government at an early age, and he rose very rapidly in governmental circles. Came from a fine family, had the finest education that one could have in England in his time, and he very quickly rose to become clerk of the Privy Council. He was therefore one of the principal secretaries of state to His Majesty King James I. He was giving all kinds of contributions to the British government for a good number of years, but all of a sudden, all of George Calvert's contributions to the government in England became almost meaningless. They became almost meaningless because he announced to the officials of the government that he had officially converted to Roman Catholicism. Well, when he converted to Roman Catholicism in England of those days, he had to give up most of his titles. He had to relinquish many of his government positions. And what was he to do with the rest of his life? Well, he got the idea to begin a colonizing venture. And even though Calvert had become a Roman Catholic, even though he had, by that action, had to give up a lot of his positions and jobs and the like, still the king held George Calvert in a tremendously high regard. So he said, well, I'll let you do whatever you want to do. You can't serve in government, but what would you like? And Calvert said, I would like to begin a colonizing expedition to the New World. The king said, fine, you tell me what tract of land you want, and it's yours. So Calvert began, first of all, in Canada, in the area of Newfoundland, started a colony which was named Avalon. The colony did not go very well because the weather was so cold, most of the people who went over there to engage in the initial venture came home to England once again. So George Calvert said, well, may I have another tract of land in a warmer climate where I can begin settling people? The king said yes. And that's the story of how the Ark and the Dove went to the Chesapeake and arrived there in 1634. George Calvert himself was not the man who was going to live to see the beginnings of colonial Maryland. George Calvert would die in 1632 in England. It fell to his brother Cecil Calvert to undertake the actual work of the colonizing expedition, and it fell to Cecil Calvert's brother Leonard to actually be the member of the family to accompany the colonists to colonial Maryland, and also to serve as the first colonial governor once a governmental structure was developed, once a governmental structure was set up in Maryland. So, we had a number of noblemen whom George Calvert initially attracted to this venture. We had Jesuits and we had servants. All of them came here. And of the Jesuits, there were three of them. One was a most unusual and a very wonderful man. His name was Father Andrew White. He was a rather well-known diarist, and this is what he wrote in his diary. In this place, on our Blessed Lady's Day in Lent, March 25th, 1634, Feast of the Annunciation of the Blessed Virgin Mary, we first offered Mass, erected a cross, and with devotion took solemn possession of the country. Well, these people got off the Ark and the Dove, and they were immediately met by representatives of the Piscataway Indian tribe. Now, the Piscataway Indians in Maryland were completely unlike the Iroquois Indians that poor Father Isaac Jogues had encountered in Quebec and in upstate New York. These were a very friendly Indian tribe. They had initial negotiations, and it was the Piscataway Indians who first led these settlers from the ship after they had said Mass and brought them to what we would call today St. Mary's City, right at the very tip of southern Maryland. It was at St. Mary's City that the first actual city developed in colonial Maryland. It was at St. Mary's City that the governmental structure of the colony first took shape, where the social and economic life of the colony indeed began. Now, of these Jesuits who came, Andrew White and another man by the name of John Altham were priests, and Thomas Gervais was a Jesuit brother. They were all very holy and very spiritual men, but certainly Father Andrew White stands out of the three of them. Andrew White gave up a very influential teaching career in England to take on the life of a missionary in the New World and to serve as chaplain to a number of these noble families once they settled in Maryland. Not only that, Father White wrote a dictionary. He wrote a grammar of the Piscataway language, and he baptized hundreds and hundreds of Maryland Piscataway Indians. He brought them into the church. Marvelous man. Very, very profound missionary. So he was a unique feature of colonial Maryland, to be sure. Another unique feature of the colony was the fact that from day one, while the Catholics were in power in colonial Maryland, religious toleration was practiced. That's something that even William Penn's holy experiment in Pennsylvania could not completely brag of. But in Maryland, religious toleration was practiced, and it was practiced from the very first day of the colony's existence. And finally, another unusual feature about society in Maryland is that these were Catholic noble families who came to Maryland. They were people who had led a very comfortable life in England. They were people of wealth, people of affluence. They were looking for a comfortable life in colonial Maryland. They were looking to live in the same kind of comfortable homes, to have the same kind of education for their children and so forth. So you have a unique type of society being created. And when you have families like the Brooks and the Carrolls and the Brents and the Neals, what did you have? You had people establishing very, very handsome homes in the southern Maryland countryside and practicing their faith with a great deal more freedom than they were able to have practiced it in England. So large manor homes were erected, chapels were built, Mass was offered, and many servants, many people who had worked for these noble families in England continued to work for them when they came to colonial Maryland. The Catholic families in southern Maryland lived within about 2 miles of each other, in rather rural settings, and the Jesuits would usually go from one manor house to another, saying Mass, baptizing, giving instructions in the Catholic faith, and so forth. These manor homes, places like St. Inigo's and Newtown, both in St. Mary's County, Port Tobacco in Charles County, White Marsh in Prince George's County, and a number of others, really became the focus of Catholic parochial life in Maryland in colonial days. wasn't too many years before parish churches began to develop. Registries of baptism, marriage, deaths, and so forth began to grow up. Stable congregations began to flourish, and Catholic life came to fruition in colonial Maryland. Also, there were a number of parishes which grew up and which developed on the areas that had formerly been Jesuit farms. Now, these people, as we say, were noble families. They were families of means. They were families who were very accustomed to having a comfortable life in England, and they wanted the best for their children in this country. And the best, of course, meant the best in education. So they began establishing schools in colonial Maryland. They began a school at Newtown, which the Jesuits conducted, and they eventually began one at Bohemia Manor, which was even more successful. These schools in southern Maryland would correspond to what you and I would understand as grade and high schools. And once they finished, the Catholic children finished these schools in colonial Maryland, they would go to the continent in Europe for their college education. Some of them went to France, some of them went to Ireland, some of them went to Italy, some of them went to Spain, the Catholic countries where they could receive the finest education that was known in the 17th and in the 18th century. Religious vocations among these people in Catholic colonial Maryland were few. There were only three or four Jesuits in the 17th century to come out of colonial Maryland, and there were, I suppose, no more than two or three vocations to women's religious orders. In the case of the women, it's even more understandable why you had so few in those days. The dowries that individual families had to present to convents were so large, that the fee was so astronomical, that it became difficult, even for people of means in southern Maryland, to allow their daughters to enter convents in Europe. So for a number of years after the initial colonization of Maryland, religious vocations, particularly among women religious, remained very low. That would begin to change somewhat at the end of the 18th century when the Carmelite sisters came to the village of Port Tobacco, Maryland, to establish what would be the first convent in the colonies. Well, by the mid-18th century, by 1750, there were approximately 20,000 Catholics living in colonial Maryland. Again, most of them centering around the areas where the Jesuits had originally established their farms, those same areas that became Catholic churches. All was not success, all was not positive accomplishment by any means. As the non-Catholic population began to grow and develop in Maryland, there was a great deal of bigotry that became directed at Catholics. This would have happened certainly in the decade between 1649 and 1659 when the Puritans took over in England, the period of the Protectorate and Commonwealth of Oliver Cromwell. Well, when the Puritans took over in England, they also took over in Maryland. And much of the religious toleration that Catholics had fought so hard for was done away with when the non-Catholic ascendancy took control. After the Stuart Restoration, things were somewhat better. But then you had the Glorious Revolution coming up in 1688, 1689. The Stuarts were overthrown. The monarchy of William and Mary came into power. And once again, there was a great deal of religious bigotry directed at Catholics. It was not until 1720 and even later that the climate moderated somewhat, and one Roman Catholic could write to another friend in Europe these words: "Though deprived of our rights and privileges, at least we are now enjoying peace and quiet here in colonial Maryland." Isn't it interesting? They fought so hard for toleration, and yet they were deprived of it. Very significant that a non-Catholic American historian by the name of Sanford Cobb could write something like this: "In the face of the remarkable fact that during the half century in which the Romanists governed Maryland, they were not guilty of a single act of religious oppression, the legislation against them was warranted and base." Very, very objective, very balanced comment from a historian, once again, writing outside the household of the faith. Well, from Maryland now we come to Virginia. You do not think of a great deal of Catholicism in Virginia, but there was some. You tend to think more of places like Jamestown and Williamsburg and Bruton Parish Church, and the Henrys and the Randolphs and the Lees and the Jeffersons and the Washingtons and so forth. But there actually was a Catholic presence in Virginia, and it was the presence of the Brent family, and particularly a gentleman by the name of Giles Brent of Richland. The Brents had actually come many years earlier from Maryland to Virginia, and Giles Brent became in his day the most prominent Catholic in the colony of Virginia. He was a very gracious man. He was a very religiously tolerant man. For example, Giles Brent wanted to bring a number of French Protestant Huguenots from France to settle in the northern neck of Virginia, where they would enjoy religious toleration. Louis XIV in France had revoked what was called the Edict of Nantes. Now, the Edict of Nantes was a piece of religious toleration which said that everyone could worship in France. Well, in point of fact, they could not. Louis XIV was saying, if you're not a Catholic in France, you can't worship. So you see, if the Protestants were anti-Catholic in colonial Maryland, the Catholics could also be very anti-Protestant, and they were in France. And all these French Huguenots had no place to worship. And Giles Brent of Richland was very, very willing to welcome these good people, but through a number of political intrigues, that particular plan never came to fruition. He also wanted to bring persecuted English Catholics to settle some years later in the same area of Virginia. Once again, his plan did not come to fruition, but he certainly was a religiously tolerant, open man. Richland was a large manor home, and the Brents continued there for many generations. You have Bobby Brent's Landing out in front of the large manor home. And when Father John Carroll returned from Europe to the United States to begin his ministrations and ultimately to become our first bishop, it was at Bobby Brent's Landing in Virginia that the young Father Carroll came. After Virginia, we go to the holy experiment of William Penn in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was chartered in 1681, and really the colony of Pennsylvania, since it was inhabited by so many Catholics, gives us a pretty good idea of what urban Catholicism was going to be about. After all, Philadelphia was becoming a very economically profitable city, and there were a lot of Catholics settling there, and it shows us the urban composition that Catholicism was going to assume, particularly as we start getting closer now to the American Revolution. Who came to the colony of Pennsylvania? Who came first to Philadelphia? Well, we had a number of Irish Catholic servants who accompanied the English and Welsh Quakers who came in William Penn's original party in 1682. As we get into the next century, we have a number of Catholic Rhinelanders who came from Germany. They came first to Philadelphia, and then they moved ultimately to the hinterlands and finally to Lancaster. You had a rather large German Catholic population settling in a number of small communities in what today would be the Pennsylvania Dutch country of the Keystone State. You had a number of Scotch Highlanders who came to Philadelphia but eventually made their way to the Alleghenies. These would be Gaelic-speaking Catholic people. And you also had a number of French Acadians who made their way down from Canada and settled in the eastern port cities of Philadelphia, Boston, New York, Charleston, South Carolina, and the like. These French Acadians, by the way, were immortalized by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow in his famous poem Evangeline, when he wrote these words: "Under the humble walls of the little Catholic churchyard, in the heart of the city they lie, unknown and unnoticed." There were two very famous Catholic churches, churchyards, in Philadelphia. One was Old St. Joseph's in Willing's Alley that had been begun by Father Joseph Grayton, a Jesuit, in 1729. You can still go to Willing's Alley and see Old St. Joseph's today. It's part of the National Historic Landmark, which comprises Independence Hall and so many of the other buildings that played such a substantial role in our country's early development. Well, that was Old St. Joseph's on Willing's Alley. It was begun by Father Grayton, as we say, and it was composed of all of these various ethnic groups. And they were people who were, for the most part, I think we can describe them as tradespeople. Some of them were tavern keepers, laborers, servants, sailors, and as we say, these somewhat unusual French-speaking Acadians who were a different ethnic group to themselves. Many of the German Catholics who settled in the city of Philadelphia and outside the city of Philadelphia were ministered to by a very famous German priest named Father Ferdinand Steinmeier. When Father Steinmeier came to this country, he assumed the name of Father Ferdinand Farmer. Father Farmer labored in the hinterlands of Pennsylvania. He went into East and West Jersey to say Mass for any of the Catholics he found there. And he certainly became one of the leading Catholic priests ministering to the German Catholics in colonial Pennsylvania. Ultimately, he would move from Pennsylvania to New York, and he would be the first resident priest in the colony of New York. So we've looked a bit now at Maryland. We've looked a bit at Virginia. We've looked a bit at Pennsylvania. And finally, we want to say just a few words about colonial New York. Remember that New York had been settled by the Dutch. We remember Peter Stuyvesant and all of those good people. Well, in the period of Dutch colonization, you really do not find any significant Catholic presence. You find isolated Catholics, certainly. But we have to wait until after 1664. We have to wait, in other words, until after the Dutch leave and after the British take control of New York to see any really substantial Catholic presence in the colonies. The colony had been New Netherlands, and the largest villages, of course, were New Amsterdam, which would be the present-day city of New York, and also Fort Orange in the north, which would be the present-day city of Albany. All of that changed, of course, when the British came to New York in 1664 and renamed it. It became the proprietary colony of James, the Duke of York. James was the brother of King Charles II in England, and when Charles II would die, James would become James II of England, and he would be the final Catholic monarch in England. Well, while he was the royal governor of New York, New York became a royal colony with James as royal governor, there were a number of Catholics who held at least reasonably significant offices. By 1683, the most prominent Catholic who had come into the political life of the colony of New York was a man by the name of Governor Thomas Dongan. He actually did the administration of the colony for James, the Duke of York. Thomas Dongan was a native of County Limerick in Ireland. Again, he rose rather quickly in governmental ranks under Catholic auspices. And as governor of New York, he was the one who established the famous Charter of Liberties, religious toleration in New York. Governor Dongan opened a Latin school. He was a man who welcomed French Huguenot Protestants into the colony of New York as royal governor, or as representative of the royal governor, I should say. He was also the governor who insisted that the Sephardic Jews in New York, that is, the descendants of the Jewish people who had been there since Dutch times, that those Sephardic Jews should be enrolled as free men of the colony of New York and allowed to engage in commercial practice in the colony. Dongan retired, of course, after his term of office ended. He bought a farm on Staten Island, and he thought he was going to live very peacefully, quietly, comfortably for the remainder of his life. But then something very interesting happened in England. What happened was the Glorious Revolution, the overthrow of the Stuarts, the coming to power of William and Mary, William of Orange and his Queen Mary. All of a sudden, Catholics, practically speaking, had to go back into hiding. Things became very difficult for them. They knew that if they were going to practice their religion, they would have to practice it somewhat quietly, if they could practice it at all. No one knew, in other words, after the Glorious Revolution, what state they would be in if they were Catholics, depending on how much toleration would be extended to them in the various parts of the world in which they lived. Well, Governor Dongan thought to himself, here I am on Staten Island, living peacefully and quietly and so forth, but is my life going to be all that comfortable? I don't know. So he decided to leave New York, and he went to England, where he lived quietly and died in the city of London in 1715. These are some thoughts, then, on Catholics in the British colonies. In Maryland, in Pennsylvania, in Virginia, and in New York. They contributed substantially in every colony you found them. They were a real presence. They were a minority, but they were a real presence. And they were beginning, ever so slowly but ever so surely, to make their presence felt in colonial America, in the city of Philadelphia especially, but also in Maryland. The days were coming very, very soon when they would be able to say, we're as Catholic as anybody else, we're here to stay just as much as anybody else, we are just as American as anybody else, and they would get their opportunity during the American Revolution, and it is to that revolution we will turn in our next episode.
Thank you.